This is First Cast.
Hi everybody and welcome to First Cast. This is Matt Crash from 263.
This is Connor Ryan from 1403.
And this is Adam Richards from 1341.
Arifin Berry from Team 108 and Team 408 Mentor.
And Greg Merritt from Team 177.
And I'm Jeff Rodriguez from 173.
Bringing to you the second episode of First Cast. Let's see what we can do. Today we got our couple headlines. We have the 2006 regional event capacity released. What do you guys think of that?
I know when I saw that the Boston regional, the new regional, could only hold 25 teams, it kind of confused me because Beantown Blitz, also held in Boston but at a different venue, was about in the high 30s. 39 is the official list, but I'm sure one or two teams dropped out.
Yeah, I also noticed that Wisconsin only holds 25 also, since that's the other new regional.
In terms of new regionals, I don't think that's anything that's what they've lived up to before, you know?
Yeah, that's true, but it's probably pretty good. Anyway, let's move on to some other news.
Everybody, a quick note. During episode 1, apparently some people misunderstood what I was talking about with the field glitches. I had never meant for them to be attributed to IFI. I was actually commanding them on being able to bring the field to full operational capacity while dealing with all those bugs.
Thanks for that correction, Matt.
Also, in our last episode, I mispronounced the name of our website host. Tim Ginn is his real name, not Jin.
Okay, yeah, so now that we've got those things cleared up a little bit, why don't we move on to our first guest today, Arifin Bari from 108 and 408.
Well, I would like to thank you, Matt, Connor, and Adam for inviting me to talk to you guys about transmissions. Personally, I'm really a newbie. I have learned a lot through Andy Baker and John Vinoon. My first suggestion would be get with a mentor who knows a lot about transmissions. You will learn a lot from them. Talk about transmissions. When I think about transmissions in general, I think simple. I like to think simple because simple is the key to the success. Now, there are different kind of transmission, 1-speed, 2-speed, 3-speed. A lot of teams has like different preferences. My preference would be for a first, like a very fast game, I would like to have a 2-speed transmission. If I can go with a 1-speed transmission with about like 8 feet per second, I would be good to go. But also, I would use 2-speed if I had any game that needs a pushing power. 3-speed transmission, I personally think is overkill. A lot of people talks about three motors, putting a three motors on there, putting two motors on there, or even one. Personally, I think three motors is overkill, but it is good to use it when it's only one speed transmission. Check out some transmissions like Paul Copioli's from this past year for Team 217 Thunder Chickens. They had the three motor transmission with one speed, which went about 9 feet per second. 229 almost had the same robot. They had the 2-speed transmission with two motors, which went pretty fast too, and both teams did well. So, you know, when you look at transmission in general, you will see pros and cons. You just gotta decide what you want to and what you believe will work for you the best.
So this past season, one of the things I've noticed was a lot of teams went with the kit transmissions, which were 1-speed. What do you think of those?
Well, I personally think the 1-speed transmission was a really, really good idea. Thanks to John Vinoon and Paul Copioli for working on those and, you know, getting those to us. It saved a lot of time for, like, a lot of teams. For example, the rookie teams, I'm pretty sure they would have a really hard time, you know, who doesn't have any experience at all, to come up with a 1-speed or 2-speed transmission in general. So, you know, they actually had a robot working by that time, so they had much more time to work on their mechanism in general, which was a really good idea.
My team also, we had a major shift this past season, and while we're still getting acclimated to everything, having to build a transmission probably would have pushed us over the time limit. So I know the kit training really saved ours. One other thing I wanted to ask you, though. Like you said, you prefer simple, and you think multi-speed transmissions are overkill. If you have to go with 1-speed, would you prefer speed or power? Personally, I prefer to be able to push stuff around.
Personally, I would go for both. I would keep my robot to go about 8 feet per second with enough speed. In another word, if you look at 217's transmission this past year, they used three motors on their transmission, but at the same time, they were able to push people around. So it's basically you have to design a transmission which you want the speed and power at the same time. That's what I prefer.
This brings us to a big debate, which is power versus speed. It's one of the disadvantages that everybody has to face, and when you're coming to designing, it's one of the it's the forks in the road that you really have to get around. It's kind of why everybody likes the whole idea of having a continuously variable transmission, right?
Yes, you're very right. Now, it's really up to the teams or a single person to decide what they prefer and what they want to use or whatever they feel really comfortable with. You know, I mean, if I was to build a robot by myself or to mentor a team, and that team needs a lot of really help, you know, I mean, I would tell them what I think about it, and I would take their input, you know, and we would come together as a team and decide that which would be the most comfortable for us to use. It can be a 2-speed, it can be a 3-speed, it can also be a 1-speed with, like, going about 5 feet per second, or we can have a, you know, 1-speed transmission going about 12 feet per second. It really depends on what your team is comfortable with.
Well, the thing with the higher speeds I've noticed is a lot of the robots see getting to 9, 10, even 11 feet per second. How easy is that to control? This year we were running with this basic kit transmissions and 10-inch wheels, and our driver had a lot of trouble trying to position for a cap on a goal. He had to keep tweaking it back and forth. After a while, we just put speed limiters in the software, and he was able to control it fine.
That's when the driving and the controllers come in. Personally, I think is if you make a robot and then give the drivers and the operator to practice with for about a week, they should be able to control it really nice. For example, Team 179 Swamp Thing, they had about 2 weeks to drive that thing around. You know, Titus and Amanda both had it down very well, and their robot was going 12 feet per second, and, you know, it was really, really fast. If you saw it in person, you know, you would be amazed by how, like, well that chassis was. And they were able to control it. So I believe it's up to the drivers, actually. It's for the whole team to decide what the speed of the robot should be. And then the mechanical and electrical people and the team comes together and builds a robot, gives the robot to the drivers and operator, and says, break that thing so we can fix it now, and not, we don't have to fix it at regional or nationals.
Okay, well, thanks, Aaron. Why don't we move on to our second guest today, who is Greg Mara, talking to about the CMU camp.
Yeah, what's up, guys? I just want to thank you for inviting me to be on the show.
It's great to have you here. Now, the CMU camp, interesting sensor we got last year. Those of you who know me know autonomous is my favorite part of the game. So when we got the sensor, I was pretty excited, but it turned out to be a lot harder than I thought. Craig, can you tell us about some of the hurdles team ran up against?
Yeah, if you guys watched the kickoff, I'm sure you saw the part where Dave had the little robot following him around in that blue Hawaiian shirt. And it looked like it was going to be pretty easy to program the robot using that new scripting language to get all the CMU cam hooked in there. But when it actually came down to it, it was a lot harder than it looked. The CMU cam is actually a pretty complex piece of hardware. They cost about $200 if you buy them separately. And it's got a little camera on there. It's got a lower resolution than a cell phone camera, but it hooks right into the PIC microcontroller, so you can control it a lot better than you'd be able to a cell phone. This year in the game, the vision tetras were what you wanted to cap. You wanted to cap them on the goals, and you scored bonus tetras. But the hard part was, since you only had 15 seconds, you had to be able to locate the tetra, drive to it, pick it up, drive to a goal, and then cap it. And that was really hard to do. I mean, you saw during matches, human drivers would have problems picking up tetras and capping them on goals. So expecting the robot to be able to do that by itself was a pretty daunting task.
Also, one other thing, like you said, 15 seconds isn't a lot of time. Do you think FIRST should stick with the CMU cam if they're not going to lengthen autonomous, or do you think we should go for some simpler sensors?
Well, one of the interesting things about the CMU cam is, since it's got its own onboard microcontroller and it controls the servos itself, as soon as you turn on the robot before the match actually starts, the camera will start to do stuff. So before the match, our camera was panning back and forth across the field trying to find the vision tetras. So the second that autonomous started, we already knew which vision tetras were placed on the field, and our driving code, which didn't actually work so well, was supposed to be able to drive to them and pick them up just as soon as autonomous started.
Okay, so this year, though, the thing with the vision tetras was, if you get them capped, it was quite a nice bonus, but it was also really difficult. If you could pick what next year's sensor would have to find, and we got another CMU cam, can you think of something that might be easier to work with, easier to locate, maybe?
I don't think the challenge was in locating the vision tetras. I think the challenge was in actually manipulating them. Despite how easy the task looked, only a couple teams were managed to cap vision tetras at all during autonomous, and nobody managed to cap on the center goal during actual gameplay. I think next year they need to pick an easier task to do with the cameras. Like maybe you could have a zone that if your robot drives into, you get a small bonus or something. Because that would be easier for rookie teams, especially if they don't have a lot of experience with programming.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was a relatively big feat for all the teams to come with it. Right, guys?
Yeah, you're right, Connor. On that note, you know, about the CMU cam, I would like to congratulate two teams that I saw in person, Team 237 and Team 66. Team 66 actually, like, capped the goals, but Team 237 had a really, really nice robot. A very simple chassis with a very simple mechanism. They came really close every single time, and, you know, they did a great job. So I would like to congratulate both of those teams, and I'm sorry for the ones that I missed. I probably haven't seen you guys in person.
Also, 237 actually did get a side gold cap during one of the regionals, I believe. I saw a video of it. It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, I did too. I'm familiar with the code that they had going on behind that. It was a pretty elegant solution that they came up with in terms of capping the Tetra. They had the camera tilt up and down to locate the Tetra, and based on how far down they tilted it, they knew about how far away the Tetra was. So their programmer, Mike, came up with a pretty good way to approach the problem.
Yeah, we tried to implement something like that, but just as I finished debugging the trigger routines, we decided to scrap the camera for weight, so... But I have seen the code, and I've talked to Mike about it. We're actually working on possible revisions for next year if we get the CMU camera back. I gotta say, he's a pretty good autonomous programmer. I haven't seen many like him.
Just as a quick question, do you guys think the coding will be similar or a little different next year?
What's interesting is if you look at the Vex robots, the programming modules, I'm not sure if they're publicly available yet, but I got to see them over the summer at WPI, and it's pretty cool. It's in between LEGO Mindstorms programming with those really simple blocks and actual full-on C programming, where you have to actually know what you're doing. So it kind of gives the user the blocks on one side and the code on the other, so they can see what they're doing and then go in and tweak it even more in the C code if they want. I think it's a good way to teach kids how to program, and it gives them more of a hands-on experience and let them actually do something, rather than just have to delegate it to the really geeky kids on the team.
Thanks for that, Greg. I didn't know about the whole programming module, but you know, I do have a Vex kit, and I play around with that a lot of times, and thanks for that, letting me know how exactly it works. Now I'm like more excited to get to it, you know. Thanks.
Greg, also, I saw some stuff posted on CD a while ago about a modular programming system for the FRC controllers, sort of like the one you just described for Vex. Do you know anything about that?
I did see that thread, and I saw that, and then I saw the Vex stuff, so I kind of assumed it was similar. So maybe they're working with the same people on that software, but since that rumor, I haven't seen anything else about that.
Me neither, but it looked kind of interesting. I'm not sure if it's such a good idea, though.
Well, they debuted that new scripting language this year, which was supposed to make the autonomous programming a lot simpler, but if you actually delved into it, it was very limited in what it could do, and it required a pretty advanced knowledge of sensors to set it all up. So if you already had that much knowledge about sensors, you probably knew a thing or two about programming already.
I think it was more meant to speed up development than to make it easier. I mean, it is a lot faster to fill an array full of commands than to write out each one of them.
Yeah, but I don't think the time saved is really significant. I think what they were trying to do was lower the barrier of entry to rookie teams. Because I know on our team, we have a really solid programming mentor staff. We have Mr. Betts, who just won an Unsung First Heroes Award, and another mentor, Mr. Gaston, and they're really good at the programming, and they know what they're doing, and without them, we wouldn't have been able to do a fraction of the things that we did.
A question for you guys. How many teams that you talk to actually use that scripting language you were talking about?
Well, I can say my team definitely did, and we were looking over it, and like Greg said, we found it to be quite limited, so we decided to skip over it, and we went with the old favorite, a Dead Reckoning routine. That worked quite reliably, actually.
From what I believe, this year we used a recording program just to record all our movements and then play them back. It worked pretty well, but we had some issues setting it up.
We tried to set up something like that, the EEPROM thing. Ours was playing back in reverse. It was a little weird. Like, when the arm's supposed to go down, it would go all the way up, then it would drive backwards into teachers, people, you know, walls.
Yeah, before we get completely away from the CMU cam, one of the cool things on the CMU cam is, while it's not wired in the kit, you can wire in a standard video output to plug it into a television. So I think one of the things that 177 is going to try to do in the preseason is build ourselves a little security camera for our pit. If we get the motion tracking mode that's built into the CMU cam already, and then we hook it up to a projector in our pit, we could have a little thing that follows people that walk back and forth in front of our pit and projects them onto the wall.
Oh, that'd be nice. Definitely a good way to get attention.
That's definitely something we're going to have to check out.
So it has a motion tracking mode. Do you think it'd be useful for locking on to, say, a specific robot and following them?
Well, one of the things with the motion tracking mode is the way it tells if something's moving is the change in the pixels. So if you have a still image and then something moves, you know it's moving because the pixels are changing colors. But if your robot's driving, it looks like everything's moving. So it's really not that good for following something versus tracking something while it's stationary.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah, that would be interesting. The robot would flip out.
But the color tracking mode that's built into the camera could be useful next year, even if it's not officially part of the autonomous routine. Because let's say you have painted areas on the field, the camera makes a pretty good navigation system by itself. You just drive towards blue, and then you wind up where you want to wind up.
That reminds me of another question I had. Under the goals this year, we had yellow triangles in the carpets. Do you know of anybody who tried to find the goals by looking for yellow and pointing the camera down?
I believe that that's how 237 found the goals. Most of the teams that I read about tracked the yellow to get to the goals. Our team was a little bit different. We had a field coordinate system, so we knew where the robot was on the field all the time and where the goals were all the time, so we didn't really need to use the camera to navigate. But that system wasn't really completely done this year. I think we had some hardware problems with that.
Sounds interesting. I'd love to get into it, but we have some other stuff we want to bring to the listeners of our show. Thanks for all your help with the CMU cam, Greg. And now I'd like to bring it over to Jeff Rodriguez for the first history segment.
All right. Thanks, guys. I have been involved with the program since 1999, was my freshman year in high school. And I graduated in 2002 and have been reffing in 03 and 04, and now I'm back mentoring this year. I certainly haven't been doing it as long as many other people out there, but, you know, you fall in love with this program. The year that sticks out in my mind, although a little bit biased, is 2002 for obvious reasons. Does anyone have any questions about 2002 game and all, and what happened that year?
Could you give us a brief outline of how that game exactly worked?
In 2002, the game was called Zone Zeal. It was two-on-two. The two robots on your alliance started at the opposite field from the opposing alliance. The field was broken down into five zones, the middle zone being the neutral zone. The zones farther out from that corresponding to the color that they were closest to, and the zone beyond that being kind of like a less important zone, but also corresponding to the color. The zones were important because there were three goals that started out in the middle of the field. Those goals, if one of those goals was in your zone, immediate adjacent to the neutral zone in the middle, it was worth 10 points. If it was in the zone farthest from the neutral zone of your color, it wasn't worth any points. There were also, I believe, 40 soccer balls on the field that year that were worth, I believe it was 1 point each if they were in the goal. The significance of that farthest zone from the neutral zone in the middle was that the soccer balls counted there, with the goal not counting for the 10 points, but the soccer balls also counted for that zone adjacent to the center goal. So basically, at the beginning of the match, all your robots would hightail it to the middle of the field and try and control those three goals, and then proceed to fill them with balls and score points.
That sounds actually pretty interesting. Definitely more interesting than last year's game. A little more complex, too. But, so, why, in your opinion, does that one stick out in your mind?
2002 was my senior year on the team. It was my third year as the arm operator on the team. And that year, we had a great core students, great mentors, and we came up with a great robot. We performed really well at the Long Island Regional and won that. We placed second at the New England Regional. And then at Nationals, we were eventual national champions with Team 71 from Hammond, Indiana, and Team 66, now the Flyers, formerly the Penguins, from Ypsilanti, Michigan. I still want to thank those teams. We had a great alliance that year.
On that note, Jeff, I would like to just remind me of something, you know, that I didn't think about tonight. Well, tell the truth, 2002 was my freshman year, when it was my first season in first, and championship was the first competition for first that I ever went to. And what actually got me hooked was the match between U71 and 180. When I saw you guys pushing each other, it was just like, wow, I mean, this student comes up with amazing stuff, you know. And I was hooked right away.
Well, the 2002 game, kind of relating it to your discussion about transmissions, that one of the deciding factors in that game was how much torque and traction your robot had. And generally speaking, our robot didn't have a lot. You know, your big teams at year 71 with their sort of innovative file cards, and 180, the infamous Fluffy with their treads and crazy amounts of traction. And your basic, you know, your high torque robots were really just had a pushing match between the goals that year, and it made for just not, you know, real exciting matches if you didn't know anything, but if you knew about the robots and you knew how the game worked and everything, they were great matches to watch.
If I'm not mistaken, each of those goals out of those three each weighed like about 182 pounds. So going back to the robots, it had to have enough torque in order to push at least 182 pounds, and then also had to have the ability to actually fight with another robot, you know, in order to like keep that goal in place.
Yeah, those goals certainly were not light, and it took an awful lot of power to be able to push more than one of those, which many teams did.
Question, if memory serves, there was an endgame bonus if any part of your robot was in your home zone. I saw a lot of teams that things like tape measures that would shoot out and touch. What do you think of that?
Oh yes, the infamous tether rule. I forgot about that in my description. You're right. At the end of the game, there was I believe it was a 10-point bonus for your robot. When they defined robot, they didn't say entire robot. They said any part of your robot touching the playing surface inside your end zone. What a lot of teams did was use a tether, which many of them bordered on the entanglement rule. A lot of teams used, you know, as you said, the tape measure, which they basically motorized the tape measure and would just spit it out. The beauty with that being, if a robot were to drive over it, because the tape measure is fairly flat and it flexes, it didn't tangle up in any of the robots. A lot of other teams used kind of long extending arms made out of, I know there was a few arms made out of 80-20, some polycarb. Other teams used real thin polycarb sheets. They rolled it up and would just release a latch and it would unroll and get all the way back to the end zone. There were also a few teams that used sort of remote devices that they would deploy it and it would drive around on itself. It had, you know, a separate joystick or something on their control board, and they'd basically maneuver it back to their end zone. Sometimes the only thing connecting their robot and their little tethered robot was just, you know, your regular electrical cords. And a lot of teams shied away from that because they thought it would violate the entanglement rule. But if no one drives over the cord and gets entangled, it's not going to violate the entanglement rule.
Yeah, that sort of reminded me about this year when teams were trying to use zip ties to get over the loading zones. But then when they tried to get back into the home zone, the zip ties are sort of sticking out, not allowing them to get the full points at the end of the round.
Yeah, that's the thing about the bonuses. Now, I've noticed in Stack Attack, First Frenzy, and this year Triple Play, everything's very specific, the entire robot. The entire robot's got to be on the bar, on top of the ramp, or in the home zone. I think First didn't... I really think they didn't see it coming in 2002 when people started using the tethers.
Yeah, there was... 2002 was kind of a defining year for that rule, the entanglement rule. And for the other rule of no metal touching the carpet, thank you, Team Hammond, for their file card idea. If you're not familiar with their file card drive, basically, if you lay a file card, you know, the metal brushes that you use to clean off a metal file, if you put that on the carpet, because of the way that the bristles are bent, you can push it relatively easily in one direction, and it's practically impossible to push it in the other direction. So what Team 71 did was they had kind of 2 feet, and the bottom of their feet were had these file cards glued to them, and rather than picking up their feet and actually walking, they would just shuffle. They'd shuffle one forward, and then they'd alternate and go back and forth. And it really created the most powerful drivetrain I think FIRST has ever seen. And there was only, I believe, one team who was successful at pushing them sideways. No one could even push them backwards.
Alright, moving on, we have our rookie tip. Thank you to Jeff Rodriguez for that segment on FIRST history. Alright, the rookie tip of the week is start fundraising and working on sponsorships early before the season. This is very important for most teams, as my team has been trying to work all summer so that we can get the entry fee ready for this season.
Especially this year, I believe FIRST has a new policy that you are not registered for an event until you pay them, so you need that money a little bit sooner this year.
And I'm sure that everyone in this room is, or everyone here for the chat, is saying that this is a very important tip to start fundraising as soon as you can, right?
Oh, definitely. I'd also like to add the metaphor, don't put all your eggs in one basket. If you rely on one sponsor, something happens to them, it could have a huge effect on your team.
Okay, I guess we'll also move on to our new mailbag segment. Last week we said we asked you guys to send in some questions, and this week we're going to try to answer some of them. If you guys want to send some questions, send it to firstpodcast@gmail.com. So, Adam, do you have the first question?
That I do. All right, the first question is, what is the biggest challenge facing rookie teams? All right, well, in my opinion, it's got to be the fundraising. I mean, most teams aren't really expecting the $6,000 entry fee to a regional at first, and then as soon as they hear about it, they are mostly dumbfounded on what to do. I know my team in our rookie year, we had to get help from another FIRST team, Team 79, the Navigators, just so that we could get into the FIRST regional that we were going to attend. What are you guys' thoughts on this?
Yeah, definitely. This is a pretty important point in making sure that you pull everything together and make sure your organization is strong. If you have a well-organized team, nothing can really go wrong.
All right. Thank you to David Black from 696. I believe Arifin has the next question.
Yeah, my question is, what are the benefits to multiple motor drivetrain and shifting transmissions? Well, David, it is a really good question. I mean, tell the truth, like I pointed out earlier, it is really the preference that a team or a personal or an individual has, you know. But multiple motor drivetrain, most of the teams I have seen has used 2 motor drivetrains. Few teams has used 3 motor drivetrain. Now, the most of the transmission that I have looked at, all of them had success. For example, your own transmission, Team 696's Hexamax, you guys had a really good transmission this, I believe it was 2004 season. And even though that thing was probably a little bit heavy, but it did the job well. So, you know, you can't complain with that transmission. It was your preference and your team preference, the reason why you guys used it. Same goes with, okay, for example, Andy Mark's transmission. I mean, comparing to the Hexamax, it's really light, you know. And it's 2-speed, and also you can, like, go as fast as you want. With the sprocket reduction, also you can make it go as low as you want. Now, see, these are all preferences that a team uses.
I know 173, we used the Andy Mark transmissions this year, and they held up great. We didn't have any problems with them at all, and Andy Mark just made a great product, in my opinion.
Yeah, just one more thing on this fact. You want to make sure that you plug in you use the right kind of transmissions for the game style. This year, for example, was a very fast-paced game, so it was okay to have a robot that was able to go 10 feet per second or faster. But going back to what Jeff said earlier, back in 2002 when you had a power game and people were mostly pushing to move the goals around, it was okay to have a 5 foot per second robot that was still very successful.
Talking about transmissions, motors, drivetrains, you know, in general, I would like to point out a few teams that you might want to look at. Yes, I'll be missing a lot of teams on the list, but these are few teams that actually caught my eye. Team for robot in general, Team 33 Killer Bees, Team 67 Hot, Team 111 Wild Stag, Team 217 Thunder Chickens, and Team 229 Divisions by Zero. Those 5 teams actually caught my eye with their like robot in general. I mean, they had a great robot, you know, their drivetrain was cool, you know, their mechanism was nice. Also, if you want to look at some transmission, which was really impressive, look at Team 222 Tigatrons, and look at Team 233, the pink team. Team 222 actually had a ball shifter, which is really cool, and Brad, actually, from that team, has posted a lot of things about on Chief Delphi about the transmissions in general, and actually explained how a ball shifter works. Team 233 uses a globe motor to shift, which I found really, really interesting. So, you know, you might want to check those out and actually, you know, do some consideration on them.
Yeah, one thing I noticed about 233 is, while they had a really great drivetrain, at the Mammoth Museum off-season, their gear shifter actually broke. Now, I don't know the actual cause of that, but they actually had to zip tie it into high gear for the rest of the match, and it actually mostly caused them to lose the last two matches.
Since I was emceeing at Mayhem at the Museum, I believe this is what happened. I'm not exactly sure, but this is what I believe what happened. The globe motor actually got really, really hot, and for some reason, it wasn't shifting at all. They had the same problem back at UCF Regional, the Florida Regional, that is, in the beginning of the practice matches. If they started off in the neutral mode, it would really give them hard time in order to shift into like either low or the high gear. But once they're shifted, you know, it's really hard to stop them. And I'm pretty sure that if you guys have watched matches on soap108.com, also, like, you know, just in general, like in at competitions, I'm pretty sure that everybody will at least agree with me that that was probably one of the most impressive drivetrain this year.
Yeah, I mean, they even used plastic hobby chain rather than the standard metal stuff that most teams can use, though it does require a lot more maintenance. Like, they might have to replace it several times during regional. It does reduce weight a lot.
One advice to the person who designs the transmission for their teams: please try to keep it like as less weight as possible, because just realize that all the other mechanical person on the team, they're trying to build the rest of the robot too, and if your transmission takes up about 30 pounds of the weight, you know, or about 20 pounds of the weight, come on, think about it. That's like, you know, the other people has about like 70 pounds to work with, you know, or 90 pounds to work with. I mean, at least consider what others has to, you know, do with the robot, and then go with what you want to design. And also discuss it with the team in general and see what they want. It's all about the teamwork.
I think we have a third question from Connor also.
Okay, this question came from Ashley Snodgrass. What do you feel the long-term impact of VEX mid-level competition would be in the world of first? And do you think with the same age range at the first competition, that there could be long-term negative side effects to the VEX competition? So, I got a couple things on this one. It's a rather lengthy question, so let's look at the first question. I think that VEX, as a mid-level competition, will affect person first in a positive way. It can outreach to teams that have a lower budget to begin with, so that cheaper teams can start for robotics teams, but not necessarily having a full-blown FRC competition. What do you guys think on this topic?
Yeah, what I like about the VEX kit is we can take our freshmen, who up until now have been gophers on the team, we can give them the VEX kit, we can say, build us something, and this way we can find out who's got talent in areas, get them used to working with this stuff, and once they build it, us programmers can probably use it for debugging stuff. Maybe. We'll see.
I think that I'm also involved with the LEGO League, and I think the VEX kit is a great stepping stone between the kids leaving middle school who have been doing the LEGO League can go to VEX, which is above the LEGO League, but not quite at the same level as FRC, and then once they're comfortable with the VEX, they can then move up to FRC, and you have a real smooth transition where they're learning as much as possible.
Yeah, so what do you guys see this as having any negative side effects at all, besides just more competition?
At most, I might see some teams dropping FRC entirely and going straight to VEX because of the price. But other than that, I can't see anything wrong with it at all.
Well, Adam, I agree with you, but I'm not entirely sure if that falls under negative side effect. I mean, yes, it's cheaper, which means more teams can get involved, and you still have the point of first going through there, so maybe it's a good thing.
Well, on the note of VEX robotics in general, I mean, tell the truth, as everybody said, is a really, you know, nice step up from FLL in general. As you pointed out that, yeah, there might be teams who might come down to just fix robotics and not do first robotics anymore. I would like to argue that a little bit. Yes, there might be some situation when a team can't get like enough money to compete for first robotics, but trust me, if the team loves first, which I'm sure every single team do, and if the students loves first, they will do anything to get it going, just like I would, you know. And Vex Robots in general, I think it's really, really cool. You know, you can just create like really cool things. Like, for example, look at all the robots that John Vinoon has posted and, you know, showed it to us, especially the Crab Drive. I mean, I really, really like that Swerve Drive, you know. It's just very cool, and you can make it with one Vex kit. And look at it, like, right after Titus came up with the Swerve Drive, you know. It was really cool. You don't even need extra servo like John Vinoon used, you know. And look at the recent post on Chief Delph Eyes about Kyle's Vexy. Yeah, that's a pretty cool robot too. I mean, that's probably the tallest one kit robot for Vex I have seen like this past season. So it's really cool, you know. By the way, I can't help it. I am John Vinoon wannabe.
Okay. Well, anyway, thanks to everyone that sent us questions. If we didn't get to your question this week, hopefully we'll get it to another. But anyway, send more questions to firstpodcast@gmail.com. First podcast, that's all you gotta do, just spell it out. Send more questions. We look at all of your questions. We read every single of your emails. So just send us anything and we'll probably read it. It's a great way to get in touch with us. So, Matt, do you have a message?
Yeah, just following up on that. Like you said, we do read all of them, and we like the messages you guys send us. We wish we could put them all on the show, but it would be 3 hours long. Also, speaking of the show, I want to apologize for being delayed this week. It was a very rough weekend for all of us. Busy, school's beginning, so we'll try to keep them on time from now on, and we thank you for your patience. And this is John Vinoon signing off.
By the way, I would like to thank Matt, Adam, and Connor one more time. You know, I mean, seriously, thank you so much for inviting me here. And you guys are doing a great job, and I actually enjoyed the whole first cast this week because I actually learned a few things from Greg Mira, you know, when he was talking about the CMU cam. So, thanks, guys. This is Eric and Barry, Team 108408 Mentor. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to thank all you guys, too. Learned a lot myself tonight. So, this is Greg Mira from 177. Stay classy, Internet.
And this is Adam Richards from 1341 signing off.
And this is Jeff Rodriguez. Have a good night. Or day.
Congratulations, you just sat through our podcast. And this is Connor Ryan signing off.